And good evening, everybody. My name is Patrick from the Poison Pen Bookstore, and we have another one of our virtual events tonight. And we're here for the virtual book launch of Lisa Gardner's brand new book, Before She Disappeared. And we have a very special guest, Riley Sager, is here. He's going to be talking to Lisa. And Barbara is standing by from home, and she's going to be taking over. But just a few things. I'm going to be monitoring the Facebook feed here. So if you have questions for Lisa or Riley or Barbara, hey, send them on in, and I'll pop up somewhere, 35 minutes in and to ask some of your questions. So Barbara, I'm turning it over to you. And congratulations, Lisa.
Indeed. Yes. There it is. I have to find the sweet spot here on this thing. Lisa, I want to drink a toast to you. Congratulations on yet another fabulous book, which I have read and greatly enjoy. Oh, good. There you are. Is that a Dutton mug, Riley? Come on. You're not showing us the full. There it is. This is really exciting for us. We've been privileged to have Lisa here for several book launches. And mostly they have been for books with continuing characters. But here we have a book that is really fascinating. It's a new character. It may or may not be a one-off. I don't think Lisa wants to commit to that just at the moment. It's set in Boston. And I love the fact that during the events of January 6th and since, we have seen that citizens are now playing some role in law enforcement and tracking down people and helping the police. And so Lisa's book, which was clearly written long before all those events, does have a main character in it who is taking an unusual role. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Riley and see what he has to ask.
Oh, plenty. I have plenty. First, Lisa, hi, how are you?
Hi, Riley. I would like the record to show Riley is one of my favorite authors. Home Before Dark, the thriller you should have read in 2020.
Oh, thank you.
When the occasion arrives, I want to hear all about Survive the Night. And it's possible I've already tortured Dutton that I want my copy and I want it now.
Soon, very, very soon. I think they're heading out very soon.
So but, June 29th, right? Is that your publication date, Riley?
Yes, the 29th, I think, or the third. It's that the last Tuesday in June, yeah.
I think it's the 29th, and I find it amazing that we're actually discussing a book coming out in June when here we are on January 19th.
Dying. I know, it's crazy.
I can't wait, Riley. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Survive the Night, June 29th. I got it.
And Before She Disappeared, today. Now, I forget like how long ago I read this because time is now meaningless.
Yeah.
So like it really... I think it was 3 or 4 months ago, but it might have been longer. I honestly can't remember. But so, first question. Last year, you were one of the few authors who actually got to go on a book. And do you miss it?
Oh my God, you're right. So my release last year, When You See Me, like sneaked out right before the COVID lockdowns. And so I got to see Barbara at Poison Pen. It was a great night. Got to do my local hometown, fly around the country, think things that I only dream about now. Like, oh, I'm at the airport again. Oh my God, I got to get up at 4 a.m. and fly again. Now I will tell you, one of the things I do respect about the pandemic is it's a reset button. All those things I thought were dreary and mundane, I am like, so excited to do again. Please, 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 let us just be able to get up at 4 a.m. every day and catch a plane again. Yeah, that's my sad life.
I cannot wait to get on a plane again. Like I'm just, and I hate flying, but I'm like, just get me on a plane. I don't care where we're going, anywhere.
Security lines, it's all okay. Yeah,
yes.
I mean, I promise to be patient and kind. And
so I know like you mentioned on Twitter that like, you know, is this like your first virtual event or have you done some others like during that throughout the year?
This is the kickoff for the book tour. And it's the first like Zoom event I've done. Last night in my home market, I did something with my local radio station and Facebook Live, which was really a lot of fun. But So
it's Zoom. It's easier in some ways. but also I miss talking to readers one-on-one.
I miss talking to readers, Riley. I agree with you 100%. I'm very grateful. I like this format where people get to talk together, because I think all of us can agree right now, we just want to connect. But as a novelist, Barbara very kindly sent me all the books in advance. So this weekend, I think many of you may have seen the picture on social media, but it was me unboxing and opening and flapping and signing. And I'll be honest, Barbara, I miss Patrick. I miss showing up to your little back room, and it's just, it's all done. And all we have to do is, you know, sign on the dotted line. And I miss talking to readers in line. Oh, well, how do you spell that? Oh, that's so nice to hear. Oh, you have a dog. Great. I mean, I miss all of that, Riley.
We miss it too. You know, there's so much energy that comes from having an audience. And one of the great things is you never know what questions they're going to ask. It's always exciting to see what readers takes on a book. And right, authors often look at me when this is going on as if to say, did I really write that? Did I say that? How is that question somebody? And so, you know, it's less predictable and more energetic. But I think that we are incredibly lucky that the Zoom technology came along just when we needed it. So I'm very grateful.
Yes. And I think we're probably actually like connecting with readers, with more readers than we would have like traveling from store to store. But man, I miss traveling from store to store.
Agreed.
So let's get to Before She Disappeared. Tell us a little bit about it in your own words.
On the surface area, Before She Disappeared involves Frankie Elkin. A pretty ordinary person, just like you and me, no specialized background, but she is obsessed with solving missing persons cold cases. And this compulsion brings her to the Mattapan neighborhood of Boston, nicknamed Murderpan for its crime rate, to find a missing 15-year-old Haitian girl. It's been 11 months later. The police don't have any leads. The first question rapidly becomes, in this kind of really dense urban environment, how does any teenager simply disappear? And Frankie is on the case.
Now, let's talk about Frankie.
Not Dee Dee Warren.
I loved Frankie so much because she was so damaged and so determined. And she's not, you know, some like badass. Like half the time she doesn't really know what she's doing. And yet she's doing it anyway, and she's getting the job done. And so is there a real life inspiration behind Frankie?
Well, there is. I've read most of my books have been derived from either a real world crime. I mean, I think you could argue Before She Disappeared was derived from a real world hero. I had read this article on this woman, Lisa Yellowbird Chase, no specialized background at all, but she became very frustrated by the number of women going missing on tribal lands, and both the lack of resources, but she would argue the lack of interest in even investigating this case, that these poor women are just written off. And that really just moved me, that one person could make such a huge difference. But I also love this notion of an everyday person like you or me. So the real challenge behind writing Before She Disappeared is this is the first book I've ever done where it's not a detective, an FBI agent, a state trooper. Again, Frankie could just be you or me, determined to bring a person she's never met, daughter's home.
So how did you, I mean, there's always a little bit of me in all of my characters. So like, how much of you is in Frankie?
Let's see. See, and I always think as a writer, I'm the alter ego. Yeah, like I kind of write the books with characters that say and do all the things I'm just not brave enough or outrageous enough to do. So, but it's an interesting question with Frankie. I mean, the most things when I was writing the book, I was very aware, as you were saying, Riley, Frankie is not a hard ass and she's not a badass. I mean, in fact, she's even physically slight and just not even striking looking. I mean, but that's somewhat her superpower. She looks just like a neighbor, like someone who came along and, you know, she's not trying to stand out. She doesn't want to be that special. She wants to be the person kind of just move around, asking a lot of questions. And the next thing you know, you have a lead in a cold case.
What do you think about, I mean, a lot of books, crime books, focus on cold cases. They're very fascinating. What do you think makes a cold case so irresistible for a writer and for like a real life audience?
I think they're interesting because by definition, they're the puzzles that couldn't be solved. Like if there was a ready answer, they would have figured it out. I think for a while, we've talked a lot with podcasts and true crime TV, cold cases and murder. And many of them are being reopened because of breakthroughs in forensics. So now that amount is perfect for a DNA sample, or now we can do this or trace glitter or whatever. What I thought was intriguing about missing persons cold cases. So before she disappeared as a 15-year-old girl, Haitian girl who went disappeared, 11 months earlier, is in many cases, you don't even have a crime scene. I mean, police can be that lost. You have a last known location, but well, that's known to you guys. I mean, what really happened here? So in terms of cold cases, it's much harder for it to be, now forensic science has changed and we can run a test we couldn't do before. And missing persons, it's almost always gonna be about social engineering. Someone, and why not Frankie, getting someone to talk or say something they weren't willing to say before.
Right. Could I chime in and ask you, Lisa, because I think it's an important part of Frankie, what's been her success rate and what are the odds that she's actually going to be able to find this missing girl?
So Frankie has some basis in the real world. And in the real world, if you're doing a missing persons cold cases, I think we all know, 48 hours, like that really is your window of opportunity. If you're already searching for someone a year later, 2 years later, 5 years later, your odds of finding them alive are not high. However, families still want the closure. What actually happened is still a question worth answering. But at the opening before she disappeared, we meet Frankie and she's haunted because she's been doing this work for a bit now and she's gotten answers. She's not brought anyone home alive. And that's kind of her mindset when she approaches Mattapan and before she disappeared.
So she's mission driven. She's a middle-aged woman. And I'm sure Riley's going to ask you, what is her vulnerability? What is her weakness? Because that's an important part of what you write about and quite haunting, I think, when you read the book.
I think one of the fun things, and Riley talked about this, is that Frankie is not a hard ass or a badass. She is just like any of us. And in many ways, you could almost argue as a recovering alcoholic, it is her illness she is bringing to bear. I mean, most addictive personalities have a tendency to be highly obsessive and self-destructive. And in many senses, you could argue Frankie, as a recovering alcoholic, is almost harnessing her addiction superpowers, trying to bring them for good. But the key to doing the work she does is to be obsessive. And I think readers will get pretty quickly, and before she disappeared, Frankie can be rather self-destructive as well.
She really was like one of the most fascinating characters I've ever read. It was such a delight. And I worried about her a lot more than a normal protagonist, because sometimes like if the protagonist is, some tough super sleuth, you're like, yeah, they're going to solve this one and make it through okay, and we're all good. But with Frankie, there are moments where it's like, I don't know if she can pull this off. Like, I'm kind of not as confident in her as she might be in herself. And that was a wonderful thing to read.
It was interesting for me because my past novels have always been law enforcement. Detective Dee Dee Warren, FBI agent Pierce Quincy. So to try to get in the Frankie mindset, and you're right, Riley, it's that she could be us. And that's what I, on scenes where I was getting stuck, I was like, okay, I'm just gonna pretend I have appeared on the streets of Mattapan and I'm looking for a girl who's been missing 11 months with no technology, no forensics, no insider track. Who would you talk to and what are the questions you would ask? And that very much became the book, but it's makes it kind of fun because you're reading someone who's operating with you as you go through the book.
Yeah, she was very relatable, demons and all. Like she just, yeah, she was just a fantastic protagonist. And so I'm going to ask about Matapan, because that was a very interesting place to set this book. And, you know, the nickname Murdapan. So why did you set it there? From the area, did you know about its reputation before you decided to set the book there?
I lived for years in Boston. And I mean, I've set a lot of my books there. And if you live around Boston, I mean, everyone knows Matapan, or its kind of infamous nickname, Murdapan, because it's one of the highest crime neighborhoods in Boston. But it also is very famous for each year. There's this annual, they call it the Caribbean Parade, which is really kind of Haitian community, Southern Caribbean. And that kind of combination of this really rich cultural heritage. But yeah, this is a rough inner city neighborhood where one poor girl disappearing wouldn't necessarily make headlines.
But I think you also captured very well this sense of community in terms of, like, you know, there's some people sort of huddling together to protect their own, and then there are other people who are sort of joining Frankie to, like, get to the truth of what happened. And it was a very interesting place to set a book. Now, one more question. Probably you don't need to answer this because you probably have heard this before. Will we be seeing more of her in the future?
All right, so I'm just going to confess it all up front. This is my first standalone in 20 years, which might now be the first book of my next series. Yeah, so I've started the second book, Riley, I believe based on Instagram. You and I have about the same page count right now.
Last week, it was a big old zero, yes, for me.
Yeah. I like how we keep each other comfort for this. So I can't let Frankie go. This is kind of how I keep ending up a series, is I create these characters. And then, I mean, I think you get to the end before she disappeared and you want to see her again. I mean, it was just the most natural thing to do. So yeah, next year's book will be a Frankie book as well.
Wow. Can I chime in?
Very happy.
Say, you know, this is something I really have thought about, Lisa. Endings are hard. You know, there are a lot of books that start with a real bang, and then somehow or other, they just don't deliver the end. I remember years ago talking to Manette Walters, and, you know, she made a point in saying that the end of the book has to be as good or better than the beginning, or the reader is left, you know, unsatisfied, unhappy. And I'm not giving any spoilers, but I have to say, I thought you ended this book brilliantly. I really love the last line of this book. No peeking ahead for any of you picking up your copy, because you don't want to do that. But I really thought that you delivered one of the great last lines in this book. And I was—
Oh my gosh, thank you very much, Barbara. I'm really good at the first line. I will tell you, I really, really sweat over that last line.
But for me, I find that by the end, I'm just so tired of writing the book that I just really wanted to be done with it. It's like, I don't care about the last chapter. Here, just take it.
Riley said that very well. That's how the sausage is made, pretty much.
Right? It really is. Yeah, we don't want to reveal too much. But and the first chapters are always so good because you're like, I'm excited. I can't wait to write this. And then, but by the end, it's 9 months later and you're just sick of reading your own words and just, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You've been in the coal mine you've been underground.
So what is a typical writing day for you?
I like to write first thing in the morning, possibly because life has a tendency still to get away from us. And before conscious thought's almost good for me, at least get a few pages down. And then, I have three dogs, a kid, life happens again, you get interrupted. I generally try to, I live in the mountains and I love to hike, do something outside because that's really how I kind of think. So I'll kind of digest what I did in the morning, realize everything that was totally completely wrong with it. The word "the" now really pisses me off. You know, the kinds of, you know, post-writing mental conversations we have with ourselves, Riley. And that brings me back in the afternoon to try to repent and do better and take the morning and try to make something of it. So That's my day in all its tortured glory.
Well, you sort of answered my next question, because I was going to ask, and I have to preface this by saying that you are very good at what you do. You are a master at what you do. I'm curious with writers, other writers, like, are there days when you just look at what you've written, or you just sit there looking at a blank screen and just think, God, I suck?
Yeah.
Like, does that happen to you? And I think it does, because you just admitted it.
Yeah, it's so funny to me. So this is one of the biggest things I've had to learn as a writer is I sold my first book in 1991. So this year marks the 30th year of publishing, you could argue. And I don't find it any, like, 1 minute, 1 second easier than it was 30 years ago. I like to tell myself that's a good thing. That means each project's fresh and original and has its own set of headaches. But this may be what depressed people tell themselves to get up in the morning.
No, I think the same thing, to where I forget, I'd read somewhere that it did get easier. Like, oh, once you get, you know, a couple books under your belt, it's easier. And every book I keep waiting for that moment where, like, oh, it's is it easy yet? And it never happens. And so I'm kind of relieved to hear that from you, because it makes me feel less of an amateur myself. But yeah, it's hard sometimes. Like, self-doubt is a very powerful drug, and it's very hard. Like, no matter how many books you sell or how many, you know, wonderful emails you get from readers, there's always that little bit up here where it's like, you can't do this.
I think the number one trait that unites all artists is I'm a fraud. They just don't know it yet. Like, and across any platform, books, you know, in Hollywood, painting, it doesn't matter. All artists will tell you, I'm a fraud. No one's figured it out yet. It's learning to live with that. I don't know what the right word is.
And it seems so unhealthy, doesn't it? Okay. But yet we do it. So I'm curious, because I like to hear, you know, because you've had such an amazing career. And I'm curious, have you ever been, like, recognized on the street? Or recognized in public?
Like, someone came up to you just kind of wildly and randomly on the streets in Paris, France.
Wow.
So for most novelists, each country is its own contract. So I actually have 30 publishers. I mean, right now we have Before She Disappeared out with the United States. But actually, when I'm not talking to fine US readers about this book, I'm actually talking to my French readers right now with my release over there, which is Look For Me, which is brand new to them this month. And the French book market in particular loves the kind of suspense you and I do, Riley, the kind of domestic suspense. I mean, this is the land of Daphne du Maurier. But they're also really into authors or images. So, like, if you go to Paris and you walk down the streets, the posters for books are less likely to be the book cover and more likely to be an image of the author. So because of that, and I happen to have done very well in France, sometimes when I'm over there for my publisher, back in the days when we did things, got to travel for our publishers, I have had people come up to me in the streets and train stations and be like, oh my God, you're her. And I, of course, look behind me, because what else are you going to do to that statement?
So you've probably also seen people reading your book in public.
That is still the funniest, weirdest experience to me. I mean, again, so I sold back in 1993, moved into suspense and had the perfect husband, became a best-selling suspense novelist, we'll say year 2000. And still, the actual year, I was, like, on a plane and realized the person in front of me was reading my own book, was just totally, completely mind-boggling. I think really, and we're talking probably, like, you know, 12 years into my career, I convinced myself my mom had a warehouse with a lot of copies of my novel.
Did you like talk to them? Did you like tap them on the shoulder and be like, enjoying the book?
Yeah. My daughter's like, go say hi. I'm like, no. I mean, she and I both are readers. It's like, as much as we love reading and we love authors, I mean, you can't imagine anything more like looking up and there is George R. R. Martin in front of you. It would just be too much.
which happened to me, that happened at Thriller Fest when I won the Final Girls won the ITW award. I was giving my speech and like right there, like 5 feet away was George R.R. Martin. And I was like, this is so surreal. This is so bizarre.
Isn't that the best moment? I mean, you and I both are members of the International Thriller Writers, and I was there that night when you won that award, and I was so excited for you because Final Girls is one of my all-time favorite novels.
Oh, thank you.
But we have our writing heroes, and no matter how big you get in this career or how well the books do, your writing heroes remain. And these moments when you're at these conferences, like, you know, Thriller Fest in New York, and you realize, that's actually, you know, like the person I'm totally in awe of, and I could like reach out and touch them. Those are cool moments in our job.
Yeah, there are a lot of cool moments in what we do. And it's sometimes like, do you ever feel like guilty? Like I'm, you know, like I have the coolest job and other people don't. And maybe I feel a little bit bad about that.
I'm kind of sulky because in the time of this pandemic, like other people are now like working from home in their pajamas. Honestly, Riley, I thought that was for us.
That was our territory. Yeah, and that was, everyone has it. Yeah.
Yeah, really. I'm a little miffed by that.
that is true. And it's weird. Like, have you had trouble adjusting to the whole thing? I have not, because this was my life to begin with, really. Like staying at home.
Yeah, I'm losing my marbles. I mean, but for me, it's, you know, it's that adage, you know, give the busy person something to get done and it will get done, because we're not traveling anymore, which used to be a third of my career was going to see Poison Pen. Tonight, I should be with all of you in Scottsdale. With a third of that gone, there's like, I have all this time. And so of course I now get nothing done. I'm sorry, Emily, you didn't hear that.
You know, it's been interesting for us because we looked up, we have an archive we hadn't really paid that much attention to because we were always too busy, you know, to really look at it. But now we've had a chance and we realized that our first event like this was in 1995. And the first author that we did a video and audio presentation with was P.D. James. And we've been doing this now forever. So we think one reason that our customers have transitioned so well is that we always did this. Lisa, you know, when you were at the store that, you know, we were always had the video going and you were always on Facebook at the same time that you were talking to me in front of a live audience. We've added podcasts. So for those of you who are watching it, if you like to share the news, there'll be a podcast tomorrow of Lisa and Riley and I talking. So, you know, there hasn't really been a transition. And I think when we go back, when people can travel, when you can get on airplanes again, and, you know, I had my first vaccination today and they give you a card, which is really nice. And I'm thinking that for the safety of all, that there's probably going to be a requirement that people show cards to get on airplanes. I think Ticketmaster has already said they're not going to sell tickets, you know, to major events if you can't show that you have a vaccination. And we're not going to let people into the Poison Pen in large groups unless we have some proof that they've been vaccinated. It would be really irresponsible, I think. So the question is going forward, you know, when you can travel again, we can continue to do the videos, but can we do other things with Zoom that we haven't thought of yet? Or we're doing a lot of overseas events with authors that were never going to come to the store, or combinations of authors that were never going to come to the store. So I do think that this is going to change things in lots of ways that we can't fully anticipate at this moment. And maybe you need a cataclysm like this to force a reset. You know, I mean, I'm trying to take a positive look at this because there are so many negatives to it. But if we think about it, maybe, you know, we have new tools that we can go forward with to reach large audiences. I mean, literally thousands of people can see this event when, you know, maybe it was like 300 people when you were actually at the store, plus whoever watched it. So I think we all have to be conscious of that.
And I think it's taught us to, like Lisa said earlier, to appreciate certain things and also to sort of learn new skills. Like Lisa, have you had trouble writing during all this? Like it took a lot for me to finally like buckle down and focus and just work on my job.
I would say most authors, writers, artists, again, will say, Americans will say attention span is an issue. I mean, first you're trying to learn about the pandemic, and we had 8 million questions for a long time for 2020. Now politics is all consuming, and just, I mean, I don't think our country has ever been this eventful for, you know, a couple hundred years. So I think most people are distracted. And it's interesting to me, writing has been a challenge, but I'm almost obsessively reading. I mean, I don't know about you, Riley, but I mean, I'm like, I'm over binge watching Netflix. I can't think of anything else I'd like to watch on. So I'm just reading. And that part's a lot of fun.
I go through phases. Like I went through the, you know, the Netflix phase, and then I went through the I'm going to read every book in existence phase. And then I was like, I can't concentrate on this book. I don't want to read anything. And then it was back to Netflix. And then it was staring at the wall. And then it was back to, so now I'm back in a reading phase, and it's been very, very good. And writing, which is also very good. Now for me.
I caught that. Okay. Oh yeah. By the way, yeah, I am writing the way he says it. Yeah.
writing now is a bit away from the chaos of everything. The past 2 weeks I've been writing quite a bit, because it's like, I don't want to focus on all that stuff. I'm just going to retreat into my own little world of words, and it's been good. It's been very therapeutic, I have to say.
Okay, so I have a question for you now, Riley. This is the stuff that surfs writing boards now. So when I was writing Before She Disappeared, which started before the pandemic, but went into the pandemic, for the timeline of the book, I just ignored the pandemic, which so many authors have done. But now as we start on the next books, and this has gone out over a year, and yours is coming out next in June, Survive the Night. Does the pandemic happen or not happen in your novel? Because we're all kind of struggling with, do we suddenly have face masks and book scenes?
This was completely accidental, because I came up with the plot and started writing it before the pandemic, but the whole book takes place in 1991.
Ah, very well played. I like it.
And I really lucked out with that, because when I was writing it, you know, finishing it up over the summer, I'm like, I don't know what I would have done if I hadn't already planned this to take place in 1991. And it's set in 1991 because I wanted there to not be cell phones.
Yeah.
And it was just easier and more suspenseful to be like, okay, she has to use a payphone and she has to find a payphone. So that's why it's set when it's set. And it just happened to be like, you know, good timing on my part. As for my next one, I still haven't decided. I might set it post-pandemic and have a reference to it, or I might set it like, you know, 10 years earlier, just to avoid all that.
One of the fun things for me about doing Before She Disappeared was, you're right, this kind of issue of technology. We're all struggling with it in suspense, because it feels like, you know, with cell phones and social media, you can track anyone anywhere at any time. So now where's the mystery? Where's the suspense? And one of the things I got from writing this book is, you know, Frankie herself doesn't have technology. She can't even afford a smartphone. I mean, she's a nomadic bartender. You know, she has to live within those means. So it was fun her having a flip phone and not having a computer. I mean, she's not going to magically come in and crack some encryption software. Ooh, this is the answer to the riddle. And it also forced me to face this issue. If you're going to disappear from someone from Boston, it can't just be the technology is the fix. That can't be the answer. It could be the questions and the stuff they tried. But I mean, if the police force can do license plate reading technology and surveillance cameras, and again, retrieve all the contents of Snapchat, which I didn't know, but I learned for this book. It has to be, and none of that worked. And it was fun, like you said, that technology has to be almost removed from the equation. That's what didn't work. We're back to the old fashioned, ask questions, listen to the answer.
But there's another aspect of this book, which I thought was really interesting, we haven't touched on, which is that she's a private citizen, right? She's mission driven. Yeah. And she's arrived in Boston from someplace in order to locate this girl. How do the police, you know, she's going to have to interact with the police at some point. And, you know, that sets up a lot of conflict, which is an important part, I think, of writing crime fiction. You have to have conflict.
When I was reading about the basis behind Before She Disappeared, and there are people in the real world, again, who do this, everyday people who either volunteer time, services, expertise to work these cold cases. One of the questions really became, okay, so you're doing this, you know, you have to be so incredibly high conflict oriented, because you're right. I mean, the police are not going to accept any layperson getting involved in an investigation. And a community, I mean, like Frankie arrives the day of, I mean, she's an outsider. And then there's the family, like you, a total stranger I've never met. No, again, you're not a cop, you're not an investigator, you're not anything. Showing up on my front porch to tell me you're gonna randomly bring my loved one home out of the goodness of your heart, I mean, it just doesn't fly. So all of them talked about, it's, you know, a high conflict job, I guess is the way of putting it. But I like that for Frankie. Again, this is where the obsession wills out. I mean, she doesn't care if everyone hates her. Her contract is with the missing girl, Angelique Budeau, and she's gonna do whatever it takes to bring her home.
Well, that's true, but the police could actually shut her down if they really wanted to. So she has to find some way of interacting with them so that they don't do that.
She's just asking questions to ordinary people. The police cannot shut that down. It's not like she's treading upon crime scenes or things like that. But, and again, this comes from real life. Frankie is aware she has no jurisdiction or no powers. So, I mean, she up front is like, anything I learn, I'm going to hand over to you, because it's not like I can make an arrest. So I like to argue she plays well with others, but others don't necessarily play well with her. And that really doesn't actually bother her either.
That's a really good point. You know, you're such an obsessive researcher. I mean, I've known you forever. We've talked together for so many books, and you do so much research, but this is one where I'm not sure that research really is a major factor. You know, you're talking with somebody that, as you keep pointing out, is just an ordinary person, you know, an alcoholic and mission-driven and all the rest of it, but not a super person, not a law enforcement person and all. So was it odd for you? Did you do a lot of research, or was this a book where you could really kind of let yourself go without having to do all that usual research?
Well, this actually was a shock to me. Okay, so I'm going to write an everyday person. I mean, Frankie's supposed to be a stand-in for you or me, okay, trying to do this. So you think, I should not need to do research because Frankie's just going to be like us. But the truth is, again, it's a cold case. So when the first one, at the beginning of the crime, I mean, some investigative work was done. And if Frankie's going to come in 11 months later, she still has to know and account for what evidence has been gathered, what questions have been asked, what steps have been taken. So to that end, I approached the Boston police. And it was very interesting to me for this book, because I had thought the puzzle would be all about how does Frankie find this missing girl? And by the time I was done talking to the police, I'm like, oh my God, the puzzle is how the hell did this girl ever go missing in the first place? The amount of forensics and technology, you know, kind of just brimming through a city like Boston, they're like, it would be highly unlikely we could not get her on video someplace, or we could not get, you know, ping our phone or do this or do that. And yeah, they can get Snapchat. I mean, it was interesting because I did all this investigative work, and it's the stuff you don't see, but everything that matters for how could this girl go missing. It was almost like an inverse negative of book research.
Great answer. Thank you. I've thought about it a lot since I've read the book, how you managed it. And so thanks for explaining.
Yes. Well, that is all the questions I have for you. So I'm done with my inquisition.
Thank you so much, Riley. Okay. Tell us about Survive the Night, because I want to hear more.
Okay. Real quick. Survive the Night is about this college student named Charlie. And she's leaving college because her best friend was murdered. And Charlie feels guilty for leaving her best friend. And so it's a combination of guilt and grief. So she's leaving school, and the only way she can go back home is through the campus ride board. And she meets my guy named Josh, and they get, you know, he's like, I'm going to Ohio, you're going to Ohio. They get in the car. So they leave at night in 1991, and Charlie's friend was murdered by a serial killer known as the Campus Killer. Mm-hmm. And as they start the drive from New Jersey to Ohio, Josh, the man Charlie's riding with, there's some holes in his story, and she starts to suspect a couple things, and sooner she starts to, you know, think that she might be in a car with the Campus Killer.
Oh my God, that is awesome. I love that.
So what does she do now? Because they're speeding down a highway at night, so there's really not many places she can go.
So why don't we invite Patrick to come back in then, see whether he has questions from the audience that he would like to, or that he will posit to us. Patrick, are you there?
I am here. Yeah. This has been a great conversation. Really been enjoying it. And I have a lot of people watching, you know, saying how much they like both of your books, and not a lot of real questions, but one of them, Lisa, is with this first in a new series, did you go in kind of with the intention that this was going to be the first in a new series, or was it something that kind of asserted itself as you were writing it?
So when I first started this book, I had the concept of the character Frankie, but it really was a standalone, as we call it. Like, the book was to be good in and of itself. Though I'll be the first to say the concept of a woman that goes from town to town, you know, searching for the missing, the rest of the world is forgotten, is a pretty good series concept. But I swear this was going to be standalone. But no, yeah, now it's totally the start of a series, Patrick. Just.
let's see, a couple, you know, it's interesting, readers' responses when you're talking about how are we going to deal with the pandemic in their book? Are we going to? Readers seem to think, God, I do not want to read about that now. You know, it's just too close and we're still going through it. We're not sure how it's all going to shake down. But there are a few readers who mentioned, you know, Michael Connelly's latest book, the Mickey Haller book, in which he does touch on it. He has, and it's kind of minimally done, wouldn't you say, Barbara? I mean,
yes.
It's the beginning of 2020 as the character kind of goes through it. And so he's hearing about this strange virus, and it doesn't go too much farther than that, but.
It's almost like we're in February of 2020, you know, when it was just creeping towards us. You know, this is a subject, Lisa and Riley, that has been debated many times over the events that we have been doing for the last few months. And so far, most authors have not wanted to embrace the pandemic as part of their books. They've either, as Riley, and you know, they're writing in a period before, or they're going to just move to the future. And part of it, I think, is not only sort of an aversion, but we don't know how this is going to play out. Instead of trying to write it now when a book is not going to emerge for another year, it's automatically going to date whatever you might want to say at this moment. So, you know, I think that majority of authors we've talked to have felt that. They would write, either ignore it or write around it, and then maybe deal with it later when it was more something you could look back on. And, you know, I'm trying to remember back to 9/11. Do you remember after that, how many books, you know, were canceled, and how many authors felt that anything they wrote at that moment was crap, you know, didn't address this national tragedy, and maybe they would just throw their books away and, you know, think about it. Yeah, I think when you have a major dislocation like this, it's very difficult to write about it while it's happening or in the immediate aftermath. You need some time to process it and think about it.
I'm going to agree with Riley. It's nice if you just, as novelists, we need a break. And I mean, Patrick, you're saying readers are kind of commenting the same. I mean, living with it's hard enough. I don't necessarily want my creative space filled with it as well.
Well, it's like the whole culture has PTSD to a certain extent.
Yes, exactly.
And, you know, we're all just, we want so badly for it to be done, you know, so who wants to read about it?
No, it's not just here, Patrick. It's also, we did a political thriller event on, believe it or not, January 7th. It's a question, you know, that immediately arose because, you know, if you're writing a political thriller, you couldn't possibly have made up the events that had just occurred. So what, you know, how do we process that? I mean, this has been, there have been so many cataclysmic dislocating events within a, you know, within a few months. It's very difficult to know how any of us want to think about them or experience them or forget them or comment.
I'm going with Riley, a possible serial killer driving you through the night. I mean, really, seriously. I mean, that's why we're reading these books. We want something.
People are watching Bridgerton.
But also resolve.
Yeah, with Bridgerton, I just was like, just, I want to go to like a ball in London, just see lots of people in nice clothes. That's just what I want. So
yeah, but
I'm tempted to err on the side of escapism.
Okay, but let me point this out to you, and I remind people of this. Bridgerton is basically Regency, or it's actually George III, but we're in the Regents because he's clearly locked up somewhere, you know, while this is going on. So the actual Regency goes on for the last 4 years of the Napoleonic War. But think about this. England was in that war for 20 years, and no one knew how it was going to come out until Waterloo, the very last battle in 1815. It was 20 years of complete, you know, insecurity, chaos, whatever. And yet when you read Jane Austen and when you read these books and you, you know, even modern writers writing about it, that doesn't really come into play. But it was shaping all of their lives. You know, so are we going to do the same? You know, are we going to treat, imagine 20 years of not knowing whether you would win or lose to Napoleon. 20 years.
I will just say, I love Julia Quinn's novels. And I noticed, Riley, because you and I are a lot alike as writers, that you had posted on Instagram, you're now reading historical as well, because I've been on this huge Regency historical binge. And I like historical, I love suspense, I love fantasy. I mean, I read all across the board, but historical, Bridgerton just seems like almost topical. Like, again, our desire to escape.
Yeah, I just, it's been, the current times have been way too much for me. So it's like, I loaded up on historical mysteries, you know, murder in the streets of London. And I'm like, okay, yes, that's where I want to spend the next month.
Oh, one of my favorite novelists, Sebastian St. Clair novels. Oh, I wish that.
C.S. Harris, right. C.S. Harris.
Thank you. Say it again, Barbara.
C.S. Harris, and I think her Sebastian Sansira series is absolutely brilliant. And
it's
Regency, and he's a veteran of wars, but he, you know, yes, I think they are fabulous.
That's one of my favorite historical suspense series.
I think there's also maybe a hunger for reading. I read the Eric Larson book, the most recent one that deals with Churchill and the Blitz and all that period. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, it's a fascinating story, but reading people triumphing over that kind of, you know, challenge, that kind of adversity it's inspiring and fascinating. But I do have some people that are watching, and I suspect one of these, Lisa, is a plant. She says, teller Sharon asked if you've been to any body farms lately.
I signed a book for her today. I'm the one that always asks about the body farm. So yes, you might be onto something. Hi, Sharon. Signed your book. And the body farm is awesome, and everyone should go there who can. It was the most fascinating research I did. Totally intimidating, because first time I ever seen a dead body like in the wild. I don't quite know the right term for that, but they treated it with such reverence, and it was so fascinating to talk to the forensic anthropologists that it really was an amazing experience. Riley, what's the weirdest research you've done? After the snake and Home Before Dark, I'm kind of hesitant to ask this question.
Snakes, I'm terrified of snakes, so writing that scene in Home Before Dark was scary, because I mean, I was like, it's Vermont, so I'm like, okay, let's see some snakes that would be in Vermont. So I'm Googling snakes, and these horrible pictures are showing up on my laptop, and I'm just like, no. So I picked the one that seemed most intimidating, like visually, with like its red belly. So that's why I don't do all that much research. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, there's somebody with the great name of Cutter Slagle, which is an awesome name, asks, how did you come up with the name Frankie Elkin?
So Frankie's kind of fun. So I live in the wilds of New Hampshire, and a lot of times around here, people might leave out offerings for the foxes because we love our fox population and they're just so beautiful and fun to watch. So my neighbors have a kind of a fox, like the neighborhood, the cool fox, you know, comes around 6 p.m., gets a little dinner, moves along, and her nickname has always been Frankie. And so when I went to write this book, they're like, you should use Frankie the Fox. And I'm like, well, I mean, Frankie's kind of a cool, you know, private investigator. Frankie's not really a private investigator, but I mean, something along the lines. I liked it. So, you know, Frankie the Fox is making, you know, her debut and before she disappeared.
How about, isn't there, there's a cat in this book, is there not? Piper? What can you say about Piper?
Yeah, so Piper, the homicidal cat, also the fault of my neighbors. I'm a cat person. I've had cats for decades. I happen to have dogs at the moment, but I'm equal opportunity, love them both. And my neighbors have a cat who hates me, and her name is Piper, and it has been 4 years now. And every time I see this cat tries to kill me. But apparently only me likes everyone else. Don't know what crime I committed, but we really, really have an antagonistic relationship at this point. I'm just like, I will put you in a book, because that will make you, you know, like behave. But no, not even in the book does she behave. Yeah, Piper's evil, but it works for Frankie.
Andrea has a good question, which is, will you ever write a historical novel? Is that something
I'd love to read historical. And I don't know about you, Riley, but there's things I'd like to read because I know I can't do them. And like the world building in historic, you have to actually account for clothes and food and things that, I mean, my own brother once told me my characters do not wear clothes in my books. And it's like, oh, sometimes I do forget that. But like in historical, you cannot. So I think that skill set for me is not there.
Yeah, it's a whole different type of writing that you would need to learn to do. And yeah, I respect and love those who can do it and do it well.
Well said.
You know, we talked about Bridgerton. I'm going to give a plug to another series that I've only watched one episode of, but I've always loved books about that are written from the wrong end of the gun, as it's called. And I love Arsène Lupin, who is a gentleman thief. And I've only watched the first one, but there's a great new series where they're updating Arsène Lupin, who's a Parisian, and played by, I'm trying to remember, is his name
Omar Sy.
And you know, they're basically heist novels. I mean, think about The Sting or stuff like that. And that's another kind of escapism. If you know, it's a different. And anyway, I think it's brilliant, and I'm looking forward
terrific.
To watching
yes,
more.
I'm going to check that out.
Re-releasing
Netflix,
the original Arsène Lupin novels by Maurice Leblanc. And what we've noticed is that readers are really fascinating on classics that they are, you know, rereading or reading for the first time, really, classics of crime fiction. And you know, that's great, because you people writing contemporary crime fiction can riff off some of the tropes of earlier crime fiction. I mean, we're seeing like the country house mystery, you know, in modern formats, whether it's up in the Swiss Alps with Ruth Ware, or whether it's, you know, on a boat or in a theater or whatever it is, but that classic Corpus Christi concept. And there are a lot of readers who've never read the basics of crime fiction who now are interested in that. And so it's a time of republication for an awful lot of classics. And I love that. But I also think that the visuals, like the Netflix thing. Riley, have you watched the first Arsène Lupin?
I watched the first two episodes of it, yes.
Did you like it?
I loved it. Yeah, it was, I didn't even know anything about it. I was just like sort of flipping through, I'm like, what do I want to watch? I'm like, oh, sort of a heist at the Louvre. This sounds sort of cool. And I watched it, and it just was like, it just grabbed me. And I love that character. It was, yeah, it's a very, very good show.
I think so too. And it's really updated with the guy that is playing Lupin. But I mean, I read all the original Arsène Lupin, and now it's really fun to see it taking on new life. So yet another benefit of the pandemic is that people have had more time to read, you know, more time to invest themselves in and things they might never have gotten to if life weren't kind of on pause. All right, Patrick, back to you. Sorry.
Yeah, let's see. There's, someone named Dana asks, Lisa, she says, the new movie Promising Young Woman seems to veer close to early Flora Dane territory. Ooh. Do you have any thoughts about this?
I haven't gotten to see the movie yet. I've been really wanting to. But I will say what I've gotten from at least the like the teaser or trailer is it's just a lot of common elements. I mean, again, the kind of victim turned vigilante femme fatale. I mean, I think it's all La Femme Nikita is almost like the ground we're all retrotting. I kind of go with this. It's not the story itself, like all seven stories that can ever be told are in the Bible. It's the way you tell the story. How this movie is doing it is one way. You read my books and Flora Dane and find her, and that's my voice. So I consider that unique.
You know, a few minutes ago, you were talking about, a little while ago, you were talking about how in your reception in France and maybe in other parts of the world where it's, I've heard this from a lot of authors that when they go over there, they're, you know, even if they're writing in the crime genre or they're treated, you know, amazingly well over there. This is a question for both of you and actually for Barbara too, which is there any author that you've encountered in person where you've had that kind of starstruck feeling?
Gosh, plenty.
Really?
You, Lisa. Yeah.
No.
I once made an absolute idiot of myself at Book Expo. And I hadn't really read him, but I was, for some reason or other, thrust into a room with Dean Koontz and I found myself incoherent. And, you know, and I thought, what has happened to me that I am so paralyzed here? And
you've met everybody.
Well, that was a long time ago, but we do notice it with fans who come to the store. You know, it's really fascinating to see, and that I'm sure you guys miss that, how your fans react to you. Well, some of them are paralyzed, some of them are ecstatic, some of them are trying to look cool. You know, some of them have never heard of you and so they're eager to meet you. And we're in year 31 of the pen. So we've had a long history of watching people react to authors in all kinds of ways. Some of them incredibly stupid or embarrassing for them. Well, and we've had authors tell us hilarious stories about encounters they've had, you know, with fans where people blurt out things that because they're kind of paralyzed by celebrity, they might not really have said in ordinary circumstances. So, but you know, we're all guilty of it. I've been guilty of it. I'm sure you have. Riley, who's an author that you've met that, you know, has left you kind of in that dumbstruck mode?
The biggest was probably Margaret Atwood. And that was, I like in hindsight, I'm just so humiliated, but like, she was at a thing at like Thriller Fest and like, I didn't have her books with me or anything. So I just was like, could you sign this notebook? I'm such a huge fan. I love your books. And she looked at me and goes, you know, there are books for sale in the book. And I'm like, I know, but I have to get to this thing. I just felt like I was, you know, trying to tell her like how much, you know, I've been reading you forever and I love you. And she's like, you know, you could buy one of my books. I'm like, oh God.
Good for her. But you know, we all say that same stupid thing about I'm your biggest fan. There we are. Lisa, how's it been for you?
Oh, for me, again, it was actually in France. The Neighbor won a major award in the French market and it was presented by Mary Higgins Clark.
Oh my.
And really, I think that's the closest I'm ever going to come to meeting the Queen. And that's how it felt. And the way she was dressed. And I mean, she's one of those women, she can wear the jewels. I mean, she looks it. I mean, she is the grand dame. And when you're in her presence, you're like, I am in the presence of royalty. And it was totally, completely amazing.
And she's so down to, she was so down to earth and approachable. Yeah. And
oh, she's the nicest, sweetest person. I'm the one just like, I can't make eye contact.
My point is, no matter how we are, you know, we're all reduced to kind of babbling idiocy in a moment when we meet an icon. It just seems to be a universal reaction.
I was that way the first time I think I met James Lee Burke. you know, because he has such a charisma and such a presence. And yeah, maybe Walter Mosley the first time.
Or how about James Ellroy, or in your case, James Gremley? Right, Patrick and I have shared a lot of moments. We've been together nearly 30 years, so you know exactly how it feels.
Yeah, but it's been an amazing time. Not to go off on these tangents, but you know, just all these authors that we've had the pleasure of meeting. You know, Ed McBain and you know Donald Westlake and a lot Hillerman. All these writers who are no longer with us. It's been a pretty great period of time for crime fiction.
You have a question to wind us up with, kiddo?
Betty asks, she says, for both of you, you both have used pseudonyms for your books. Is this done to separate the different genres you write in? And do publishers encourage the use of a pseudonym rather than your actual names?
You want to go first, Riley?
Mine was a business decision. Like I had written books under my real name and they didn't sell, and I had Final Girls, and my agent was like, this could be a big book, a seriously big book, and I don't think a publisher is going to take it if we use your real name. And I said, okay, then I guess I'm Riley Sager now. And that's pretty much like the long story short of it.
Where did the name come from?
Good. Yeah.
Where did the name come from, Riley?
My agent was like, think of something, maybe use an old family name. And my grandmother's maiden name is Sager. And I said, well, there's Sager. And she's like, oh, I like that. Now come up with a first name. And she's like, and I want it to be gender neutral because, you know, the audience. And I'm like, okay, whatever. And I was going to go with initials. And my parents are named Ray and Linda. So I was going to go with RL. And I, for like a whole minute, I like cracked it. I'm like, yes, RL Sager. That's worked so great. And then it took me a minute. I'm like, RL Stein sort of has the market cornered on any RL. So Riley's kind of close and is a combination of the two. And so that's really how that happened.
For me, it was a little simpler, though I truly enjoyed that story, Riley. My real name wasn't considered pronounceable for books, and publishers really like names people can repeat, say out loud, memorize easily, and look, you know, fit nicely. So that's how I became Lisa Gardner.
A couple of last minute questions are coming in. Let's see, will you ever have a book where Frankie meets Flora Dane or Dee Dee Warren? Will there be a crossover? Any thought?
I never plan the things in advance, but I think as we know from my previous novel, When You See Me, I like bringing my characters together. They're like all my children. They should play together, wreak murder and mayhem amongst themselves. I'm that kind of parent. So yeah, possibly.
I think that's a yes.
Let's see, someone asks, Riley, are you public about what your real name is or no?
Not really. It's on the copyright page of the novel. So that is how, when before Final Girls came out and Stephen King was gracious enough to tweet about it, there was like this whole little guessing game over who I was. And some guy on Twitter like said, I know who you are because I read the copyright page of Final Girls. And I was like, you, sir, would make a great detective.
So anybody who has that question, go out and buy a book and check the copyright page. We're not going to reveal it. That's about it. I mean, we're just about out of time, right, Barbara?
I think that we probably 60 minutes is a good time. Lisa, congratulations again on publication day for this marvelous book. I think it's wonderful that you try something different and then it's going to be incorporated into the Lisa Gardner universe, you know, because you've got, well, you
know, well said.
I think it's great. You know, you've been writing for, as you point out, 30 years. And in that time, you've created multiple characters and it does create a universe for your readers and for you. That's really exciting for everybody. So thank you for joining us. It's really a pleasure to once again get to launch your book. We're delighted. For those of you watching it, I'll remind you that Lisa thoughtfully signed many, many copies of before she disappeared. And they are probably due into the Poison Pen tomorrow from Lisa's address at an undisclosed location. And we're gonna hope, Bradley, I'm gonna make a pitch right now that we get to talk to you on June 29th or thereabouts when you publish your new book.
Definitely, yes.
Yeah, we'll really look forward to it. Maybe we'll reverse this and Lisa can talk to you instead of talking to Lisa, which would be really fun. So thank you all for joining us this evening. Tomorrow's going to be a really interesting and historic day. We have a bottle of Veuve Clicquot on ice and glasses in the freezer. And at 10 o'clock tomorrow, our time, noon in Washington, we're going to be watching and the inauguration, and it'll be interesting to see how a new presidency and the pandemic will both fare. 2020 has been such a difficult year. I'm really hoping that 2021 will present us with a different perspective. So thank you all and good night. Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.